Sat Sri Akal, Assalamu Alaikum, Namaste, and welcome. You are listening to the 8th show of A Woman's World. My name is Purvi Shah, and I'm excited to bring you a show about women's dreams and challenges facing our community. Though a majority of our world and leaders in our communities and homes, women's voices are often unheard. This show aims to change that. Each week, we delve into a new story of women making dreams come true. We hope to tap new experiences and create a ground for dialogue and change. As a poet and changemaker myself, I am helping to create this ground. You can read more about my work in writing, including my book of poetry, Terrain Tracks, at purvipoets.net. That's purvipoets.net, or follow me on Twitter at purvipoets. Our prior shows have focused on sexual violence, dance, improv, innovative community publishing, immigration reform, youth organizing, and writing on history. Today, I'm excited to have you all here with me as I speak with Rupa Patel, a clinical doctor and public health professional who is taking her skills to Bangladesh and Gujarat. Welcome, Rupa, to A Woman's World.
Thank you, Purvi.
So, what sparked you? I know in our community, it's not so strange to be a medical professional. There's a joke now about this cartoon that's like, beta, it's not pronounced actor, it's pronounced doctor. So what sparked you, though, in terms of wanting to be a public health professional?
I definitely think it was the whole immigration track, was going to India every year to see my grandmother and see my aunts in Bombay and sit in the car and wonder why there were kids on the other side of the car, the window, sleeping on the streets. And I didn't understand why they were sleeping on that side and I was sitting in the car and their health was different and my health was different.
So you had that observation. How old were you? Do you remember when you were thinking?
Starting at like 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, when the kids would knock on your window.
Yeah.
And you just didn't understand why you were pulling down your window to say hello to the child, and you were also not the one carrying the cup.
Yeah. So then how did that turn, though, this feeling, right? How did that turn into, I'm going to pursue something, like becoming a doctor?
Well, I think, as you said, my you know, my background was very laid out for me. I was going to be the doctor like my father had envisioned, and I do thank him for giving me that ability to interact with people in such a close and a very special setting. You know, that privilege of holding someone's health sometimes and that trust. And then, you know, I just made it my personal goal that I would become the clinician, but then I would make sure that I was also doing something with health programming. And I think my grandmother had a huge influence. You know, there was many times where she would say, you know, I'm uneducated. My grandmother couldn't read the Bhagavad Gita. Like, I would watch her in my house in America and stutter over, you know, ka, ka, ga, ga, you know, like the syllables of the Gujarat alphabet. And she would just say, you know, make sure you help other women. You know, you're lucky you have an education. And so I think it was just, just a personal goal of making sure that, you know, I pursued a profession where it was in line with global public health and infectious diseases. And infectious diseases does entail, you know, malaria, TB, HIV, tropical medicines. And I chose that on purpose because it would keep bringing me back closer to, you know, India, Bangladesh, Pakistan, Asia, Africa, you know, abroad.
Interesting. And I mean, just for everybody to know, because I mean, you're saying really powerful things, both about family history and also the presence of infectious disease. Why is infectious disease something that is so relevant for our communities back home?
I mean, infectious disease traditionally has been, infectious diseases can be looked at as communicable diseases, and I don't want to get into too much, you know, medical jargon, but it can be transmitted from somebody else to somebody else. And unfortunately, that is in a setting where there's overcrowding. There's, you know, where there's maybe lack of sanitation. Unfortunately, that's in the village, maybe, or, you know, where it's a high population density, or those slums where I saw those kids, you know, staying when I would roll down my window when I was younger. And so in India, if you're a general practitioner, you deal with malaria, TB, and HIV. And, you know, my mom knew all these things. My mom's in the medical profession, and she trained in India. But for me to be connected, I had to really conscientiously take the extra 2 to 3 years and, like, pursue infectious diseases as a profession, because we don't see enough malaria here. Now we are with the global world. Like, my patient at Elmhurst Hospital has typhoid, you know, from, you know, coming from Bangladesh, or, you know, a TB of the stomach or the peritoneum, what we'd say. And, you know, when other doctors don't know what's going on, it's like, oh, she's from Bangladesh, you know, she could have TB, etc.
You know, I think it's amazing, Rupa, what you're talking about in terms of now movement back and forth amongst countries, right? And how that changes the medical landscape and the kind of knowledge health professionals need to have in an urban environment, especially. So I'm interested about that. And also, because knowing that you've done work in communities in South Asia, I'd love to hear, you know, how you feel like you began to do that work in Bangladesh and Gujarat. How did you decide you wanted to do that?
So I definitely knew from a very young age. I applied for Doctors Without Borders when I was in high school, and they told me that I had to be a doctor or in the health profession.
I love that. So it's like Doogie Howser, you know, trying to get into Doctors Without Borders.
And I remember there was an exchange, because I was like, can't you just take like a college intern or a high school summer intern? And that wasn't an option. Going back to how you do that work, you know, there's many ways now. So you can, if, you know, I practiced, I got my MD in 2000, 2004, but now there's Global Health Track. So you can be the young immigrant, I mean, like first generation woman, and you can say, okay, you know what, I'm going to spend almost 1 year in India doing projects, and that's part of my education in medicine. Like Harvard's Global Health Track, Johns Hopkins has tracks. It's pretty amazing what it is now. So you can go back and forth very easily. For me personally, I basically took a year off in between residency and fellowship, and I did something called International Medical Corps. And I'll tell you something, that was the most eye-opening thing, because I went to Bangladesh. I was in the 8th poorest nation. I was recruited because they wanted me to wear a salwar during my work. They didn't want me to wear, you know, a tank top, because I guess maybe they had somebody and it was offensive to the community. And the area I was in, it was, the decision making was done by the husband. So if you were inappropriately dressed, if people didn't like you, from even a male standpoint, then, you know, their wives wouldn't go to you. So I literally wore a burqa when I went to the market. And it was interesting just to see the intersections of, you know, we have those intersections here in America. But, you know, it was my first personal encounter with the intersection of, like, no mental health, no social services, you know, forget just other disease, you know, services for women. So, you know, that's what motivated me to continue doing it, and just based off my first experience.
Interesting. So as part of this International Medical Corps, did you have a team of other providers that were with you, or were you by yourself?
So I was with a local NGO, and I think what was very interesting is I had a team of local providers. I was the only doctor, the female doctor. I went for Cyclone Sitter, and I went about a month afterwards. And prior to me, through the local NGO, were some male doctors from France. And I was given a translator slash paramedic, or a medical assistant, and he was male. So it was very interesting, because I would go into this room, and people thought I was crazy because I wanted to take sheets off the bed and like cover windows, and I wanted to like make things private for women. And this concept was completely foreign. Like, they couldn't understand why I was taking a sheet off a bed, and I was like tying it on a tree, because that's where like my area was. We didn't have clinic structures. We took houses and different type of structures, and I was tying it from a tree to the like edge of the house to like, you know, covering the window and making like an area where I could take off this woman's burqa. And, you know, the man would help me put it together, you know, the paramedic. And he would leave the room. He would translate a little for me with the woman, and he would leave the room. And then the woman would just, this patient would tell me like 15 minutes worth of other things. And and there was just this blatant social structure of like, it was inappropriate to talk about your gynecological problems, your vaginal discharge, menses, anything in front of another man that wasn't your husband. And so I was seeing like 267 patients a day, and I very quickly learned Bangla, because otherwise I wasn't going to provide any good care at all. At night, I would just sit and learn like all the woman's body parts and like different like questions and answers I would in English.
That's amazing. I mean, I think it's amazing just the ways in which access to healthcare seems like it should be such a basic human right. And then, you know, both in the U.S., as you say, and also around the world, it's still such a far reach for so many people. I mean, I'd love to hear when you say that this, you know, patient or many of the women would speak on and on for like, you know, 15 minutes or more. What would they talk about?
Just more about like things about their health that they wanted, they had questions about, like why, you know, simple things. Well, I shouldn't say simple, but things such as like, you know, why is my menses a little heavy? What can I do for it? You know, I had vaginal discharge maybe a month ago. It resolved or it didn't. And so it revolved around their body and below the belly button. And, you know, they probably hadn't seen a woman for so long or in a setting where they could talk to a woman. You know, the experience was more than I can imagine. And I can explain, because it was just basic comfort of explaining the story. And I was so taken aback. It wasn't about the health services, because there was antibiotics or there was like a hospital that was very far away. But it was this whole culture of like, it's not normal to have a woman sit in a room where the windows are closed. She can take off her burqa and she can have a conversation, even if it's a 5-minute conversation with like a female provider, and just show her her abdomen or like show her like what her underwear looks like with the vaginal discharge, or show her her breast that like has something on it. So I have like two very brief stories that puts everything in a nutshell. Is when I landed, this woman said that she had a red area on her chest. So she went to doctor, or not even doctor, but paramedic. You know, Bangladesh has clinics all by NGOs, by private systems, and tech, perhaps sometimes there's not doctors, but there's medical assistants. But you'll see in rural areas, it's staffed by still male, you know, health workers, because those are the people that can leave their families and live alone abroad. I mean, sorry, in rural areas. Whereas a female, you know, it would be hard for her to like move away from her entire family and live alone in this rural area and staff a clinic.
So you were working in rural areas then?
Yeah, I was only in rural areas, like 10 to 12 hours outside of Dhaka by train. And so, and that's where my current work is too, you know, in general. So this woman, bottom line is, she spends a lot of money to come to the same clinic. And when I say a lot of money, she's taking a boat. Bangladesh is a delta. She's taking a boat to cross the river. And then whatever she had done on land already, you know, the rickshaw, the whatever, hopping on a van or a motorcycle, however she got here. And she went four times to the same clinic, and they gave her four rounds of antibiotics, thinking that it was, you know, just maybe a skin infection
of some sort.
And, you know, she comes to me because she says she has vaginal discharge, And I said, why do you have vaginal discharge? You know, it looked like candida, and you can get that from having too many antibiotics. And I said, why is she on antibiotics? So I go ahead and I look through this little paper she has, and it says something on the chest. So I go, let me see your chest. And I opened up her burqa and her blouse, and it was like a fungating breast mass. Like, this woman had breast cancer until proven otherwise, and she was 45. Like,
wow.
She had all the risk factors for it and just the way it looked. And what I was so sad is, this woman, like, every 4 months came here, and we gave her the hope that, like, we were giving her antibiotics and she would get better.
Mm.
But this whole time, like, we didn't really refer her, and we didn't, like, prepare her to get better medical care or, like, take care of her family. Like, I don't know what happened to the patient, but, you know, at the time I saw her, I wouldn't be surprised. It was, like, kind of a life-threatening spread of cancer. It was just basic access to a woman's eyes. So I just want to, like, you know, say it doesn't have to be a medical professional anymore.
Mm.
It's just anybody that's trained in, like, this is a good breast exam, you know, or a normal breast exam. And this is one that doesn't look normal and can have some of those signs of cancer. But you know what? We do that today in, like, developed countries.
Mm.
Like, you know, most of my patients know how to do their own self-breast exam. And, you know, they come at the sign that they have some abnormal nipple discharge or abnormal lump. I mean, this is just part of our culture.
Well, I mean, I think it's so fascinating because, you know, in different ways in the United States, probably this is true. But I think there still seems to be a taboo about women and our bodies, you know, and how to kind of address not only the pleasures of our bodies, but also the pains and the difficulty of kind of navigating how do we have a conversation, both at the level of comfort and at the level of then understanding what we need to do.
Yes, Purvi, I think you brought up a good point.
Thank you so much, Rupa, for sharing your stories and the work that you've been doing in Bangladesh. We're really excited to hear more about also your work that you've recently done in Gujarat. So we're going to take a short commercial break right now, but when we come back, we'll continue this conversation about public health, women, and how to make sure that we have access.